Welcome back to Shatteringness. We are going to turn our attention to the prophecy that God had shared with us regarding these last days. As I scour the news now, aware of what God had to say was going to occur, it's almost as if every headline speaks to this particular prophecy. Matter of fact, Glenn, you mentioned the egotistical nature of America's pronouncements as they try to establish the New World Order in their summit in Europe. It is particularly interesting that the second and third of the adjectives that Yahweh used to depict America in the last days, where he is providing a warning to America, and we'll speak about what that warning could mean, that he speaks of us as being arrogant, of being presumptuous, of having an artificially inappropriate perspective on ourselves. When you listen to Obama tongue lash other nations, when they are operating in a way that is far more moral and reasonable and restrained than we are, what you see is God's depiction of America being precisely accurate. And, you know, there's not a lot of things that Yahweh despises more than arrogance. You ever heard any one of the prophets speaking on behalf of Yahweh says, you know, God chose me because I'm really smart. I'm really articulate. My message is extraordinarily compelling. God chose me because I'm simply the most qualified person for this job.
Right. Now he chooses the foolish things of this world.
Exactly.
You know? Yeah.
Yeah. So, you know, since we partner in this to a large extent, welcome to the club. You know, unless you are flawed, unless you know that you're inadequate, God can't use you, won't use you. That's why it's kind of interesting that the only person that pounds his own chest and tells us how wonderful he is, how important he is to God, is the very person who never spoke on behalf of God, Paul, the founder of the Christian religion.
We'll speak of Paul's righteous boasting.
Yes.
Usually that's in the context of, look, if you think you have reason to boast, I would have more reason to boast.
That's right.
But all of this is filthy, all my righteousness is filthy.
Oh, yeah.
You
know, yeah.
So he does get the self-deprecation in there.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. But after 10 minutes of patting himself on the back, you know, he would say, you know, the presumed and supposed leaders, the disciples, you know, I am not going to take a second seat to them. You know, it presents himself. In fact, at one time, he even says that he completed the sacrifice that Yahusha was incapable of making so that, that within his own body to be able to offer salvation to the Gentiles.
I complete in my own body that which is lacking in the... That is often spun as something to say. In other words, what was missing there was the Christ had, you know, he had to go away, you know, and send the Spirit. So they say, it's often said that represents an ongoing testimonial, you know, that he's suffering with the suffering of testimony, not a suffering.
I've been of the actual business of sharing Yahweh's testimony now for the past 12 years. There has not been one moment in the past 12 years where sharing Yahweh's testimony has been a sacrifice. I have never suffered a single moment while engaged in sharing Yahweh's testimony. And if Paul claims to have been doing the same thing, he wouldn't have suffered a moment in doing so. So, I mean, it's the whole thing is just utterly absurd.
You know, you've not as yet been beaten for your testimony. There may come a time when there are people who suffer for their testimony. There may come a time. But anyway, let's not go there.
Yeah, you know, it's well, it is true that there are very few things you can do today that will cause you to be more likely tormented for your testimony than exposing and condemning Islam. It was in that particular mission that Yahweh encouraged me to claim as personal the promises of Psalm 91. And he has thus far been completely reliable and trustworthy in that regard. And so I have become probably the most viciously attacked, verbally attacked individual for exposing and condemning Islam based upon its utter lies and destructive nature. And yet I've never experienced so much as a single blow.
Right. Yeah. They can do well. They can do nothing except Yahweh allows it.
Right.
So, I mean, that's going to create a good bit of confidence.
In terms of even conveying Yahweh's message, in Yada Yah, questioning Paul, and the introduction to God, for example, in those many volumes, 7,000 pages of information, and in the Blog Talk radio show for years, and now in Shattering Myths, I would say of the tens of thousands of people who have written based upon having read that material or listened to these shows, those tens of thousands, there's probably been five over the past 10 years that have been harsh, that have been deliberately slanderous and demeaning. That's pretty extraordinary, wouldn't you say? I mean, so to say that you're suffering because you received 10,000 letters and five of the 10,000 letters were harsh is would be pretty disingenuous at that point. I mean, the reality is that anybody who is willing to take the time to study what God had to say is going to find him irresistible. You have. No, you didn't.
Well,
we didn't start off on the same page, but you took the time to get to know Yahweh, to find out what he was offering. Well, and as you've said many times, that your conclusion is rather like him, and being with him sounds like a really good idea to me.
Right. And I guess this is a good moment for me to be a little cautionary. And I think I've said something like this before. Just as your present position didn't evolve overnight, you know, you came to be convinced of this and then convinced of that. I think gradually, okay, I don't want to give the idea that I'm necessarily in a, you know, complete agreement, you know, with everything you say, you know.
Nor should you be.
I see myself as a responsible adult, eclectic individual, you know, sort of split ticket voting and, you know, trying not to be self-contradictory or trying not to contradict God. I can agree. There's much of what you say with which I can agree. There's some, of course, which I say, I don't know yet, have to wait. And then a couple things which I would argue with it, but I won't try to do so on the air, at this point, because it's something you'd have to do over, several hours over beer or coffee or something.
I recognize from the first calls that we had together to where you are today, that your understanding of who Yahweh is, your affection for him, your trust and reliance on what he is offering, your desire to be with him, has changed profoundly. You have definitely evolved just as I have. And I think the evolution here is important. Truth is not something, nor is understanding something, that you go from one moment to knowing and understanding, where the previous moment you did not know and understand. And even with knowing and understanding, it is an ongoing process. If it were not an ongoing process, if we were not growing in this regard, evolving in this regard, becoming more enlightened, correcting things that we previously thought were true, but we have learned, there's a better way to look at that, then there would be no way for eternity to be any fun.
Right. No, as for myself, thus far, you know, I'm fairly accepting of certain corrections in nomenclature and phraseology. In terms of my understanding of Yahweh as the I am who I am, the transcendentally conscious one who is forever, you know, past, present, future, transcendent of time, neither slumbers nor sleeps. That essence hasn't changed, you know. I was familiar, you know, certainly familiar with the name Yahweh, but didn't use it as much. So, you know, your arguments about, hey, if somebody tells you his name 7,000 times and you don't get the clue to call him by name, you're probably missing something. That's a pretty compelling argument. So that's always a good starter.
Yeah, it's a good starter. It absolutely is a good starter. You mentioned nomenclature, and so nomenclature is essentially the use of words. And it is, yes, naming things. And words are names for things, whether they be verbs, which are names for actions, or nouns, which are names for actual things. Words are names for things. They provide an identity to things and to actions. And when we're dealing with God's nomenclature, we should be, it behooves us to be really circumspect, to care deeply about how he described things. Because, after all, he is the architect of life, the architect of the universe, and he has offered us an extraordinary gift in this covenant. So I suspect that there are very few things that we can do in this life that are more important than coming to understand Yahweh's nomenclature.
Well, and one thing, one thing, example that I was familiar with just in that, then I have to go because I expect to go somewhere and go out into the windy, cold, windy global warming. In the Lutheran liturgy, which I was raised, you know, there's a space where they go, quoting, you know, Old Testament where it's, we sing, "Our help is in the name of the Lord who made heaven and earth." And, you know, knowing what I know now, I realized that the name of the Lord is one of those deals where they took Yahweh's name and put in quotes, you know, a place marker there in the name of the Lord. And it's like, everybody's actually, thousands of people standing there singing, "Our help is in the name of the Lord." No, our help is in Yahweh. There in the original. So you've had Christian borrowing bastardized, you know, misplacement of God's name. It's like, wow, we're so far afield, it's ridiculous.
We are.
You know?
So far afield, so far from the nomenclature that Yahweh has provided. And there is no more important nomenclature than the name Yahweh. Welcome back to Shattering Myths. I would like to share again this remarkable statement by Yahweh and then consider its implications. We were at this point in our discussion yesterday when we ran out of time. God said, "So then he will never accept or gaze upon." Now, he is speaking of the individual that is now in heaven, the individual that was gleaned, that was harvested by Yahweh immediately after the thinning of Israel at the waste, which followed the fall of the Syrian government and the destruction of Damascus. So he's contrasting the hell that has taken place on earth that is directly attributable to religious, military, and political malfeasance in Syria with the religious and military and political malfeasance that's going to take place in the Promised Land when the West Bank is given to the Muslims, and immediately will follow with over 100 million Muslims flooding into Israel as terrorists. He contrasts the earth as this hellish place of religion, of militancy, of propaganda, with what those individuals are going to experience in heaven. And he says those going to heaven will never accept, they will never gaze upon, they will never consider, ever, the religious sites, which are works of the fingers of man. That those entering heaven will not look upon, they will pay no attention to, either the Asherah, which is the basis of Christianity. She is the mother of God, the queen of heaven in the Babylonian religion. She is the wife of Baal, who is the Lord, Satan. In the Babylonian, the Assyrian, and the Canaanite religion, she's the basis of Roman Catholicism, which gave birth to Christianity at large. And that they will no longer regard, pay attention to, look upon the worship of sun god images, which, as we discussed in yesterday's program, is not only prolific within Christianity, with its Trinity, with its dying and resurrected God, with the Son of the Sun, with the sunburst, with its halos, with its celebration of Christmas and Easter, and particularly with its worship on Sundays. The covenant's lone prerequisite is to walk away from our country, from Babylon, which Yahweh defines as corrupting and deadly religious and political schemes. Now, this statement, as we have discussed, provides an extraordinarily important contrast. Heaven will be markedly different from the world that those left behind will endure. You know, one is filled with religious imagery, the other has absolutely none. This not only demonstrates that religion leads away from God, as we discussed yesterday, but that God isn't going to save, indeed can't save, won't save, any religious individual until you're willing to disassociate from your religion and consider Yahweh as he is, come to know him as he revealed himself to us, and engage in a relationship with him in accordance with the terms and conditions he has provided, meeting with him 7 times a year during his festival feasts. It just isn't going to happen. Now, Asherah was called Astarte and Ishtar by the Babylonians. She was named Isis by the Egyptians, Helena by the Greeks, Venus by the Romans. She is the leading deity, the most supportive deity, amongst the most important deities throughout these pagan religions. She is the mother of God, the queen of heaven, the one impregnated on Easter Sunday so that 9 months later she can give birth to the son of the sun. And this affinity with Christianity is extremely important. God is making a contrast now, one that pokes directly in the heart of the most popular religion on earth today. The festival of Easter Sunday is all about the sun. It was always on a Sunday. It's when the sun is in the constellation of Taurus the Bull, which was the primary representation of the primary deity of Lord Baal. It's about the earth and Mother Earth giving birth to a resurrected God, to the sun impregnating the Queen of Heaven and her delivering a child who would be considered God. Welcome back to Shattering Myths, something that ties in to a comment that Glenn had made regarding the Lutheran pledge or song, speaking of how benefits come from come in the name of the Lord, is that this Lord, this Baal to whom Asherah is associated, that's Satan. God makes it really clear that the title Lord is applied to the adversary, to Satan, as a name, because that nomenclature, to tie into something else that we discussed with Glenn, correctly describes Satan's persona and his goal, which is to control individuals, to lord over them, to be worshipped, to be have people bow down. He doesn't care if it's feigned or not. He doesn't care if they're bowing down out of fear that if they don't, something terrible is going to happen. You know, we considered the deaths that were taking place throughout northern Africa by Islamic terrorist organizations, particularly Al-Shabaab, as they relates to them killing anyone who doesn't pray to Allah in the mosque every Friday. Satan doesn't care why you bow down to him. He doesn't care why you call out to him by name, and Lord is his name. He just wants to lord over people, to control them. He wants to be worshipped as religions worship God. He does not want to be known as the adversary. That's the whole idea. The adversary can never rise above the creator God of the universe. So the very thing that Satan wants is to not be known as Satan. He doesn't want to be known as the adversary. He wants to be known as the Lord, which is why religious leaders have played directly into his hands, why the victims of religion are praying to and having a relationship with the very adversary they think that they are opposing. This concept of a Lord puts Satan in a position of power and influence over mankind. As the Lord, the masses bow down to him. They worship him. And like all of Satan's schemes, the Asherah helps the Baal Lord reinforce this deception by advancing the notion that there is a queen of heaven. Beyond this, when she conceives the Lord's son as the mother of God, these religions myth, these pagan religious myths, provide credence to the deception that has been called Christianity. With every stroke, Satan positions himself as God rather than the adversary. Now, this is the antithesis of who Yahweh is. Well, first of all, Yahweh has a name. As our friend Glenn mentioned, you know, if somebody's going to give you their name 7,000 times, there's probably a clue there that they think that it's important that you know and use their name. And the name is Yahweh. It's not the Lord. In fact, Yahweh in Jeremiah, which is an open letter to Gentiles, to Goyim, says specifically that the replacement of his name with the satanic name and title Lord is the single greatest crime that's ever been perpetrated by humanity. Now, why would he say that? Because the moment you begin to ignore the fact that Yahweh has a name, and that you don't know what that name means, and you don't develop a relationship with him on a first name basis, and not through any intermediaries, the moment that happens, if you disregard his name, and then if you disregard the depiction of the diminished manifestation of Yahweh saving us as Yahusha, which means Yahweh saves, the moment you lose sight of all of that, then you're lost. Then if you're going to have a relationship and a religious experience, it's going to be with a false god, a god of your own making. But beyond that, the moment one applies the Lord concepts to Yahweh, they have inverted what Yahweh is. They have corrupted who he is. They have misrepresented who he is. Yahweh's principal purpose is to establish his covenant family. He's the father of that family. Fathers do not act as lords. They don't want anyone to bow down to them. They don't want to be worshipped. They don't want to be obeyed. Fathers teach. They guide. They instruct. They uplift rather than have people bow down. Our Heavenly Father, with his covenant, is the antithesis of the adversary known as the Lord. Their ambitions, their goals, their nature are the opposite of one another. And so there's no greater crime than referring to Yahweh as the Lord. I guess unless you were to combine that with saying in the name of the Lord, which would even be worse, because then we're referring to Lord as a name, and as a name, it is Satan's name. Now, in this regard, we should not be surprised that the basis of Asherah's name is meant to be misleading and to serve as a counterfeit. That's what Hasatan does best. Ashar means to pronounce a blessing. It is why Catholics refer to Mary as the Blessed Virgin, as the Blessed Mother. It is why they chant, Hail Mary, full of grace, the Lord has blessed thee. It is why they seek to receive blessings from her, including relief from suffering in Catholic purgatory. Most every aspect of Roman Catholicism is based upon the Babylonian and Assyrian sun god religion. This includes the papacy, where men become known as father. You know, what did Yosha say? There is but one father. As it relates to the covenant and to God, there is one father, Jehovah. And yet popes will call themselves the Holy Father, and they want to be addressed as father. Hierarchical church order was first conceived and practiced and promoted in Babylon and also in Assyria. Nuns are derivative of the Babylonian religion, as are monks. Adoration of Mary, completely Babylonian and directly attributable to Asherah. The notion that God has a mother, purely Babylonian. The rosary and Sunday worship, Babylonian. The mass, confessions, bowing down. The sign and symbol of a cross. The golden sunburst icon placed on religious altars. Most priestly apparel, including the Pope's hat, infant baptism, purgatory, holy water, wax candles, incense, church steeples, the concept of saints, the observance of Lent, the holiday of Easter, Christmas, and of course calling God Lord, in addition to the Trinity, are all examples of religious rites, of customs, of terms, nomenclature, if you will, that was conceived and promoted in Babylon and not in the testimony of Yahweh. Religious traditions of a decorated Christmas tree. Asherah, by the way, means a grove of tall trees. The Christmas wreath in the shape of the sun. The Yule log, mistletoe. Santa's name, including Saint Nick. Santa's job, his costume, the Easter bunny, dyed eggs dipped in the color of spring, the Easter ham and hot cross buns are all derivatives of the Babylonian sun god religion. These things have no place in heaven. They are excluded from heaven, which means those who practice them, those who embrace them, will find no place in heaven. They will find heaven's door shut. Now, elsewhere in his Torah and prophets, Yahweh speaks of the poles associated with Asherah worship. These religious relics were later incorporated into Christianity as the Christmas tree and as the Christmas cross. Shia Muslims, based upon Muhammad's testimony, still to this very day, as their most important holiday, celebrate Asherah Day, named in honor of this pagan goddess. Somewhat strange for a religion that claims to be monotheistic, don't you think? But then again, Satan covets a bride. Before we move on, Chaman also addresses the worship of sun gods. Chaman was the last word in this declaration from God, letting those left behind, letting those enduring the tribulation here on earth, that the worship of sun god imagery is not allowed in heaven. Today, we see Chaman in obelisks, like I think it was Glenn himself that mentioned the, I believe it's 666-foot height of the Washington Monument, an obelisk dedicated to Freemasonry. that is found at the center of Washington, D.C., and also in the center of the Vatican. It's replicated in church steeples. Many Christian crosses bring this all together when the crosses incorporate the circular disk of the sun in their design. Even church draws its heritage because from the sun, because church, from whom the English word is derived, not only means circle, designating the circle disk of the shape of the sun, but she was a sun goddess, the daughter of Helios. These revelations create a special problem for many living in the United States. America's most enduring political symbols are sun god related. On the secular side, these include the national and presidential eagle image, Jefferson's, Washington's, and Madison's tombstones, all of which are obelisks. The Statue of Liberty, which is Athena, a sun goddess, and the Pyramid Eye on top of the nation's currency. They are an abomination to Yahweh. More important still, those showing patriotic allegiance to such symbols are excluded from heaven. It's something to think about. What's interesting is that after Yahweh tells us that Damascus is going to become a heap of ruins, after he tells us that the Syrian regime is going to fall, after he tells us that Israel is going to be thinned at the waist, becoming unsustainable as a nation, before he tells us that he is going to harvest his or children in this order of things, and then tells us how different heaven is going to be than the political malfeasance and the religious malfeasance, military malfeasance that we're experiencing here on earth. He tells us then that the tribulation is going to begin. He tells us about the occult presence and people acting as if they were intoxicated, acting if they were drugged. And specifically, what's going to happen in terms of what is appalling devastation. And we'll get to that and the details of Yahweh's prediction, because he spells it out in no uncertain terms. But first, I'd like to be able to welcome Kirk, one of my favorite people and callers to the program. How are you, Kirk?
I'm just fine. Thank you for those kind words. I had a comment because the hour was short. I had a question that was more pressing, and I was just kind of curious. When we've been studying along with you for the last 3 weeks or so on the Yashayah, and my wife asked me, Terry asked me a question the other day when we were talking about it on the Sabbath, and she said, you know, the harvest that is mentioned in there, it reads a lot like the harvest of the approximate 7,000 would be from Israel. I mean, would it not be from everywhere we are?
Yeah, as I look at that presentation, God made a specific distinction between harvesting two groups of olives, and one of the groups of olives was in the top uppermost choicest branch of the olive tree, and that would clearly be and that's the smallest number, by the way, that would clearly be in Israel. Those are naturally born Yehudim who have chosen to participate in the covenant. The larger number, and if you take these numbers here, you can have 2 to 3 or 4. Yeah, 3 to 5. And what you're dealing with here is that you get to 7, but the larger of the two numbers is indicative of a branch that is separated from that tree. It's still an olive branch, but it's separated from it, which is Goyim. That would be us Gentiles who were adopted into the covenant. I don't know if racially you have any Jewish ancestry or not, but you know I don't. And I don't think so either. And so the larger of the two numbers at this particular time, and it's not hugely larger, but a little larger, is Goyim from around the world. So if your wife
is from around the world, it's not just in this context. It's wherever we happen to be.
Correct. Absolutely.
Now, for those of us who are much older and probably may not even make it for the next till then, I think we'd be in our mid to late 70s. When Abraham and all died, they were kind of in a suspended animation, I think, or that we might assume that. And then it was in 33 CE, of course, then they got to go up with everybody. Now, is in this particular case, if someone is were to pass away in the meantime, would they be in the same situation, or would they just go directly and be with Yah?
Oh boy, that's one of the great questions. It is interesting to speculate. First, we don't really know if there was a state of suspended animation for those in what's called Abraham's bosom, which would be those who had embraced the covenant that had passed away from the time, you know, all beginning really with Enoch, but with all the way through to Abraham and on. Personally, I think that the whole Abraham bosom's concept means just in the covenant, and that I suspect that from the perspective of individuals like Dode, who Yahweh just dearly loved, and from Yahweh's perspective, that the separation would be caused to seem like no time had passed at all. Now, there may have been time that passed so that this initial harvest could be celebrated on Bukhurim in 33 CE, year 4000 Yah. But, you know, it's and we are told that, you know, that in the eyewitness accounts that some graves opened and people who had been part of the covenant were able to be witnesses. All we know for certain is that Yosha is the first child of the covenant, if you will, and that he approached Yahweh on this day, and I assume that there was a celebration of all of those who had previously died in the covenant at that time. We'll have to take this on tomorrow.